Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on the media issues of the week, some days even some insight, if you listen very closely, which I urge you to do. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, and here we are with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Hi, boss.
Himself. In my dreams. And over here is Barbara Lombardo, for many years the editor of the Saratogian, and became executive editor of The Record in Troy as well, and now is teaching journalism at UAlbany.
Hello there.
Hello there. And Judy Patrick, a longtime editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady and vice president of the New York Press Association.
It's always nice to be here.
It's wonderful to see this whole crowd gathered and for us to offer readers an opportunity to celebrate the arrival of the seventh in line to the crown of Great Britain, Prince Archie. Prince Archie is here, and we're all celebrating.
I can't wait for his brother, Prince Jughead.
Archie Windsor.
Archie, absolutely. But that is the occasion that, believe it or not, this is something that has a relevance to our conversation here. The Times Union has a blogger, Christy Barletti, who is very popular. I think she's the most popular blogger in the capital region. And for many years, she did a blog when she was single about sort of the dating and the social scene and developed quite a following. And she's a Gen X person. She now has a following among, say, young moms and has quite a following. Christy posted on her blog the first photograph of Prince Archie and his parents and wrote about the fact that it is rare that you see celebrities right after birth, such as Meghan Markle did. And her headline said, "Meghan Markle still looks like she's pregnant." And then she went on to explain, this is what real life looks like, because she's had two kids of her own. She said, instead of being
felt.
Yeah, and presenting themselves as something other than what they are, this is reality. And she credited how great this was of the royals to actually be standing out and being real. And she was immediately attacked on her blog by people who hadn't read what she was writing, who just read the headline and said, how dare you attack Meghan Markle for being herself and for sitting in front of a camera? My point being, what do we do with comments on our blogs, comments on Facebook that are simply ignorant, that are based upon not even reading what we're doing?
You know, in some cases, the Facebook community itself will call people out saying, you didn't even read the story. And I've seen that time and time again. But at that point, it usually doesn't happen until 15 or 20 minutes into the conversation, which can be 100 comments later. A lot of the damage has already been done. It is something media organizations really have a hard time with, because there's not much you can do about a Facebook comment.
Well, the other problem is that there are some very mean people out there. I hear from them from time to time here at WAMC. They just are mean. They just want to say something. And, you know, even if it could be proven that they were wrong, for example, in the case of Master Archie, that's what they're calling him, Master Archie now, it was one of the most popular things that it has been on. In fact, it competed with Trump and all his nonsense, because that's what was good news and people wanted to see it and everybody could relate to it. But in this case, I think part of what we have to deal with is, you know, chin up and just deal with it. It really disturbs me when I get these things, but I get them.
Well, I think there could be a copy and paste response after those comments to say,
"Dear Joe, you ignoramus.
You're misunderstanding the story.
Uh-huh.
Apparently you didn't read it." Now, can you do that 100 different times?
Well, it's different.
Or you can take the comments down, and Christy could write a piece that just says, I'm getting these extraordinary negative comments, which are apparently from people who didn't read beyond the headline.
But if the comments are on Facebook, it's more difficult to read them. You can't actually take them down, right?
Right, right. You can hide them from your own feed, but maybe we should do a better job of writing headlines that tell the whole story. But that really is difficult. You can't put everything in a headline.
And it was a provocative headline. I mean, that way to get your attention.
Well, that's true. And there are some stories that we actually don't open up for comment because we know we're going to get nasty comments. When there's an opportunity for somebody to be racist, there are stories that we know will get huge response that we still say, we're not even going to take comments on this, even though it would get you a lot of traffic. And in certain metrics, it's, I guess, good to get page views. But sometimes you just have to say readers cannot handle commenting on this story.
But you are both correct when you say that Facebook is different because it's not like removing something from your website. It's a different situation when you're hiding a comment on your Facebook page. And we've got something currently going on with that in Saratoga related to the school board elections that are coming up this month. And somebody was called to please take down this terribly nasty comment that's on their Facebook page. And the person who I would ordinarily think was a reasonable person said, I'm not going to step on somebody's ability to say what they want to say. But there is a line. And if you're hosting something, you have a responsibility, I think, for civility.
Well, but the problem is that when Rick says there are some times we don't want to even give people a right to respond or an ability to respond, that is his privilege, of course, but on the other hand, it's going to be used as an example of how the media, you know, organizes his thought.
Mm. By the way, if you have thoughts on all of this that you'd like to share, this and other topics, media@wamc.org, you can send us your mail and we will certainly...
We'll send it on to Rex.
We will. Here's one that our producer, Dave Gesina, has passed along from Harvey, a listener who, after a little introduction, gets into why isn't the media doing more to protect itself and its role in preserving democracy. He cites the fact that CBS Evening News, the former anchor Scott Pelley, used to say, today President Trump stated without evidence that X happened, and he attributes Scott Pelley's removal to that kind of thing. I think Pelley was actually removed for low ratings. But the question that's raised, I guess, is whether in general there is enough attention to asserting the truth of things as opposed to what is said from the White House. It seems to me that there is a lot of that, that the media more than ever is, in fact, calling a spade a spade.
Not enough. This is one of my pet peeves.
Is it?
It is, because I think we have a tremendous responsibility to repeat it every time, every blankety blank time. And when we don't, we just let him get away, or whoever's lying to us, get away with saying things that then become accepted as truth or possible truth. And there is a danger there, because then it sounds like we're whining, we're complaining, we're criticizing each time. But every time there is an untruth, we have a responsibility. Who else is going to do it if not us?
And by the way, every time I open up a paper, I read the papers pretty assiduously, and there's always an editorial in some paper defending the press and calling out those who would weaken democracy. But I think if people are going to believe it, they're going to believe it. I wanted to go back to that other question for a moment, Rex. When I get a really mean letter now, guess what I write back to them? Nothing. I think it's the best thing you can do is write back nothing. If somebody calls me a name, and that happens on a fairly regular basis, it immediately goes into the PIA file. PIA stands for pain in. Okay, so there you are. And I think responding to that kind of thing just makes them feel more whole.
Mm. You know, can I talk a little bit about the need to step up, though, and tell the story of journalism a little bit more? Because I think that's something that's missing. We don't teach civics in school anymore, so a lot of people don't understand the important role the press plays in democracy, that we are an independent verifier. We're an independent people who hold power to account. And I do think that we have taken for granted the idea that people understand that, and they don't.
But not always, Judy. Not always. If you take a look at the New York POST, you'll find, everybody makes a face every time I bring this up. Nevertheless, you know, they're defending Trump and his lies and everything else all the time.
Right, but we are not defending ourselves enough, is what I'm saying. We're not getting out there and saying, this is why we're important. This is why the press needs to know this information. This is why it's dangerous for the president to call us enemies of the people. This is why we need timely access to important information. We need our Freedom of Information request filed. And we don't tell that story often enough or more forcefully enough.
Would you do that in some new modes? How would you actually reach people, do you think, with that?
So I think on the editorial page, or doing more to explain how we work. You know, I was listening to a podcast which was suggesting that reporters be upfront about their political stance as part of their bio. I'm not really sure I'm ready to go there with that. But I think there are a multitude of venues that we can use to put out our story. And especially in the newspapers have been reticent to even talk about ourselves. We didn't put our, you know, we just used our bylines, and that was that. We didn't talk much about who we were and how we operated. I think the time has come for us to stand up for ourselves. We have just been taking it like a dog being beaten.
There's a lot of merit to what you're saying. I think in addition to that, we can't just tell people, we need to show them by what we do and maybe highlight the things that we are doing to show why we're important. So doing the types of reporting through whatever mediums we're using to make sure people understand without a press, you would not know this. You would not know
anything,
you know,
really.
Anything. From the local level to the national level to the international level.
Do we ever do anything that merits criticism? That's the other point here.
Well, certainly, that's why we're here.
Well, no, it's why I'm here, not the three of you. You're the defensive line. So I'm just saying, you know, you get a small New England newspaper where you know the publisher is a buddy of somebody, and you see a huge headline in the on the front of the paper, and people get it. People get it. They say, that ain't right. So there could be a little criticism.
Or people may be misunderstanding. Maybe they think that since you've concealed this so much, I don't know what you're talking about. But it could be that there's real news there and that people are seeing shadows where there might not have been any required.
See what I mean about the defensive line?
Well, I think there's valid point for criticism. Here's something interesting. During the general election campaign of 2016, according to a political scientist, that's a person like you, Alan, Thomas E. Patterson, policy.
Very famous.
Absolutely. Policy issues accounted for just 10% of the news coverage, which is less than a fourth of the space given to the horse race. Now, the sample was from the LA Times, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and USA Today, along with the evening newscasts of ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox, and NBC. So they're going to these few large papers, but nevertheless, it is interesting to say policy that was only 10% of the news coverage, whereas 40% of it went over to the horse race.
And if I recall correctly, which is very possible that I didn't, that same article talked about how the ratios were better, you know, 10, 20 years ago. What lessons have we learned in coverage that we've actually gotten worse in terms of presenting policy?
And you're seeing it right now. We're talking about who's up, who's down in the polls. And the other thing we're doing in the press is talking about how much money people have raised as some sort of legitimizer of a candidate. You aren't seeing a lot of policy discussion. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is putting them out by the reams full. But the horse race is something that's a quick, easy story to write, and that political reporters think that is their duty.
So let me get this straight. Would you rather that the newspapers didn't use those indices?
Yes.
And you think that, because Rex and I have duked this out from time to time, but I think he understands, as an editor, as you did, as both of you did, that you give them what they want, and that's easy to comprehend, and that's why you're giving it to them, because it is an indice that seems to make sense to the people who are reading the newspaper. They say, oh, well, he collected a lot of money.
That's another one of my pet peeves. You're pushing all my buttons today, Alan.
Well, good, then I've succeeded. Beyond my
wildest dreams. Those polls are killing me. I just cannot stand 1 minute after another, there's another poll.
They're stupid, aren't they? At this stage in the race, there's no reason to pay any attention to the horse race, right? Who's ahead, who's down? I don't care. I heard your panel on one of your shows, Alan, last month, talking about who's going to win and who I'm in for. And this is way too early to be talking about who's ahead in the Democratic primaries. Yeah. We don't know anything. We have no idea who's going to be the Democratic nominee.
It's a great example of things that we shouldn't be covering. It's something that leaves us open to a lot of criticism. And I think our reporting of some of the polls is inaccurate anyway. When we're saying on a national poll, you know, 49% of the people don't like what Trump is doing, whatever it might be. But we're also failing to say, but 97% of the Republicans think it's just dandy.
No, we always say that.
We don't always say it.
I always say it.
Well, you might always say it. That's great.
You know, I think the most interesting...
I have heard you say that.
The most interesting poll story in the last 5 years has been, how did they get the 2016 election so wrong? And that's the more interesting story.
Well, one of the reasons was because, again, according to a very interesting article in the Columbia Journalism Review by Todd Gitlin, a longtime observer, sociologist, anthropologist, he found that, this is again quoting the political scientist Thomas Patterson, the Clinton controversies from 2016, that is, from her time as First Lady, Secretary of State, and as a candidate, got more attention than Trump's. and her coverage was more negative than Trump's, 62% to 38%. That is, 62 to 38, the coverage of Hillary Clinton was negative. Trump, 56 to 44, the coverage was negative. So the coverage in these major journalistic organs of Hillary Clinton was more negative than that of Donald Trump. Of course, he didn't have any record of public service for them to analyze, so that did make it a little bit difficult.
Well, now we see the great New York Times reporting in which it turns out he did have quite a record of failure, which we didn't know about at the time.
Right. Well, an interesting question was, why wasn't that kind of a report done before the election, and would it have mattered in the election?
Well,
and it was an incredible number, the number of months and records that were invested in making that report. And if you're a news organization, you're also trying to weigh, is it worth the investment? What's going to be the result of investing so much time and effort into a report?
Well, time
I
and
wish
effort.
It had been done before
sure.
the election.
But time and effort is exactly right. It took some time and record, and it took an impetus to do that kind of reporting because Trump kept saying, you can't have any of my data.
You know, I think the media did bend over backwards to be nice to Trump during that campaign.
Yeah.
They gave him excess coverage. And the other thing is, I mean, I was an editor at the time, and I can remember getting the calls from readers unhappy that we, anytime we wrote a perceived anti-negative Trump story. And if you remember the 2016 election, there were plenty of stories coming out that we had to put on the front page because they were news. They were so kind of crazy ideas.
Yeah, the stuff where he admitted to sexual assault, you know.
Yeah, I felt like a basketball referee that kept on getting hounded by the coach, just yelling at you. No, you're not supposed to write that story. You're doing too much negative on Trump. And the upshot was that, you know, you tended to focus a lot on these Hillary emails, this Benghazi story that, you know, really should have been history at that point.
And are we going to learn from a lesson as far as the rallies? He got so much free publicity from the rallies. And now are we getting sucked into that same trap again of reporting on the rallies, even if we're not there? We as the mainstream media, if we're not covering all of the rallies, are we still even reporting what he had to say at the rallies? I think there's a lot of merit in just ignoring those rallies.
Well, Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post, who runs their fact checker column, makes a good point. He's worried about the labor intensity of that work, fact checking, because during the campaign, Trump will do 3 rallies a day. And he will lie multiple times in each one of them. We know this to be true. This is what he does. He lies constantly. And I'm saying that very directly because it is a provable fact. And I'm sorry if, as a newspaper editor, I'm not supposed to state facts that are negative in terms of the interpretation of the president. But the problem is, in doing the fact-checking and in actually analyzing all that, it takes a lot of effort. But that is the right way to cover those rallies.
Well, how do you intend to handle that at the Times Union?
Boy,
you're going to be
tough.
Fed those stories from the
Hearst,
the Associated Press, the New York Times. What are you going to do about it?
That is very difficult. Of course, we don't tend to put those kinds of things on the front page because we have enough local news that we produce that our front page is generally all local. But we do fill holes inside the paper. Holes is the term that we use. Sorry.
You're filling space. We get it.
We put stories in the... We get it because we're sitting here as 3 former editors. Well, I don't want to call myself a former editor yet. I'm still sorry. I'm just a very young man myself. But we do put those stories inside, and it's a very good question. How do you handle these stories when you have... This is his campaign. He goes out, he appears in front of people, and he says things.
And he's the president of the United States.
Yeah, you can't ignore it. But if every sentence or every paragraph is Trump said without justification, Trump said, comma, which is untrue, but that, in fact, is what you almost have to do at this point.
Or you can do a one-paragraph, two-paragraph brief saying Trump held his 39th rally of the season in Louisiana yesterday.
The CNN reporter got beat up.
Without trying to report on what he said, because then you're giving him an opportunity to repeat that baloney.
But boy, you can't say that. I mean, you wouldn't be saying that if you were still the editor of a newspaper.
I hope that I would be. But, you know, if it was the mayor of your town, or the mayor of Albany, or the mayor of Saratoga, doing rally after rally after rally, after a while, you would not be covering them.
True, but he is the president, and sometimes he does make news. Like, he did mention the amount of money that the Florida Panhandle would be getting in disaster relief, so that made a little bit of news.
Or foreign policy. He makes foreign policy announcements all the time.
Well, especially on Twitter. I mean, how much does it really mean? But, I mean, even those tweets, whether or not to report
on
the tweets.
It is important to say that the president is saying something because it carries the weight of policy.
Well, if he's talking about Iran, and it's a possibility that he's setting up a war with a country— You better believe it's important.
You have to report it, but then do you have to put it into context that Trump often does not follow through with policy backing up his tweets, or report that evidence submitted to the Congress suggests that the president's aides stop him from implementing policies that he has ordered?
How do you know that? You know that because...
It's been reported by the media. Here we go. Back to Judy's original point.
But part of our job is to add to a story, not opinion, but to put something in context using our informed presence there.
Hey.
So that's where you say, okay, he tweeted this and that, and the next line has to say, but there's no indication that his staff knows anything about this.
Barbara, every time you put something, quote, put something into context, you're giving an opinion just by contextualizing it.
That is not true.
That is true.
You know, I didn't think too much of the tweets until I read Bob Mueller's report. And Mueller refers to tweets. He's got tweets as justification for some of the conclusions he reached. So he relied on presidential tweets.
If you want to share your thoughts in this, media@wamc.org is how you get in. We can't read them live, of course, because we are on tape, or we're on whatever the digital counterpart of what used to be tape is. We're recorded anyway. Alan Shartuck, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith, and we are glad to be with you on the Media Project as we wander our way through the news of the day. Do we care, by the way? This used to be such huge news when a TV network would change anchors, and the CBS Evening News now will have a new anchor, Nora O'Donnell, the third woman to solo anchor an evening newscast, and the morning show, which actually makes money, is going to be centered by Gayle King. Does it matter anymore who is the anchor of evening newscasts?
You bet it does.
Really?
You bet it does, because people go where they like somebody. I mean, you may not like that, Rex. It may be part of your gestalt, part of your deal. But in fact, people go based on the Q rating, which is how popular somebody is.
You know, it's been musical chairs at CBS, though, for the last few years. I had even forgotten Scott Pelley was the anchor for a while.
But he wasn't. Jeff Glore has been. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, Jeff Glore. Oh. I mean, in fact, I think Jeff Glore has done a good job.
Well, his bosses didn't agree.
Well, CBS is also the context is CBS has had so much misogyny problems.
Exactly.
That they have to have a woman sitting in that seat, or they think they do.
You know, and the morning show is such a different show from the evening news. I mean, I think some people are suited to the morning show where they talk celebrities. You know, it's fluffy.
Dave Garraway.
Well, that was a different time. And like John Dickerson is moving from The Morning Show into 60 Minutes, which is a much better role for him because I frankly was uncomfortable with him doing fluffy stuff.
And he's happier about it too, I think.
Yeah.
When you say uncomfortable, I'm confused.
I'm happier.
Often when a woman says, I'm uncomfortable with that, that means there's something sexual involved.
No, there was nothing sexual. I just thought it was a waste of his talents for him to be interviewing pop stars.
Interesting. My point about wondering whether it matters is just whether enough people watch the evening newscasts for us to care.
They care. Yeah. They care because it's how they sell their ads.
You know, there aren't many women doing that, but Judy Woodruff on PBS does a great job.
Yeah, but think about that's PBS with a very rarefied, very small, relatively small audience of intellectuals.
And of the evening newscast, the audience is old people. I mean, look at this. The average viewer of Fox News is 74 years old. Average, that is. Think how old the Fox News viewers are.
Wow.
Yeah, quite old.
Well, it's true also in NPR. It's true in a lot of places that people who are interested in what's going on often are older.
No, it's which platform you're looking at.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
That the social old
media
people are going to be looking, the older people,
yes.
74 is not as old to me as it used to be, the older people are going to be watching that 6 o'clock news before they pack
bed.
In for the night. Right? and everyone else is looking all day at their phones and they're using social media.
Which is why even the conversation seems to me is somewhat outmoded because we really probably ought to be talking about what's filling the Twitter feeds.
And... Right, and not even social media, but you could be looking at CNN,
yeah,
you know, MSNBC or Fox, if that's your want, as opposed to the news at 6 o'clock or at 6:30.
Yeah. Well, it's a difficult thing to do. It's harder to track what is going on social media because there are so many millions of places where the content originates. And so when we, for example, as critics of the media or as analysts of the media or as Alan would say, as apologists for the media, get together here, we look at these big platforms, network newscasts, major newspapers. But the fact is there's a whole ecosystem out there that is much more difficult for us to track and that doesn't have individual powerful voices like an anchor of an evening newscast, but it does seep into the consciousness and it has a great impact. Anyway, finally, to talking about conflicts of interest. The editorial page editor of the New York Times is a guy named James Bennett. He has now stepped aside from any editorial page coverage of the 2020 presidential election because his brother is running. His brother is the U.S. Senator from Colorado, Michael Bennett, so among the 23 or so Democratic candidates for president. So now the question is, how far do you go about this?
That's ridiculous. I mean, when you think about it for a second, I take it Chris Cuomo, who is a big draw on CNN, will probably have to step aside. He's even interviewed his brother on the air. His brother ran for governor. Was Chris Cuomo still on the air? You bet he was. And I think people can understand that.
No, it's not ridiculous. This is absolutely the right thing for the New York Times to do. And I am uncomfortable with Chris Cuomo when he interviews his brother. I think he should step aside. I understand the need to do it sometimes, but I think this is the exact way the New York Times should handle this.
You are as pure as the driven snow.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
As usual, I agree with Judy on most issues, and I do on this one. I think that even with Bennett stepping aside at the New York Times, there's still going to be the perception, well, he's still the boss of that page.
He's still in the room.
He's still involved in it. But I think it's a reasonable accommodation to remove him from that.
My daughter is a political field organizer. She's working for a candidate for president.
Which one?
Stay tuned for more. This has been the Media Project from WAMC. I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and Alan Shartok are here. We'll get around to all of that later on. Thanks for joining us. We'll hope to see you next week.
They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Barbara Lombardo is a journalism professor at the University at Albany and former executive editor of the Saratogian and the Troy Record. And Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's Unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally...